Good afternoon. It's 12:07, and this is Midday Matters on WBOY Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday afternoon. We're going to be talking today about the 2013 legislative session that wrapped at the end of April, and we want to hear your questions and comments today. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. With me in studio, as usual, it's Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Bob, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. That's
glad
good.
To see you.
Thanks for coming in today. With us in studio as well, he's been away for a while doing, gosh, I don't know what, Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, and it looks like he took a little offense to that.
No offense. I'm sorry that it's now out, that my accounting, my time away from here is not well accounted for.
Well, we'll account for it later. And with us by phone, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Brandon, we know you're on vacation. Thanks very much for taking some time out for us today.
Not a problem. Always happy to be on, Sean.
Let's start with the big issue. It was a budget session, and a lot of business obviously going into the budget. Brandon, can you give us just a quick rundown of and I want to dig into a few more of these a little bit deeper, but I mean the big issues that that went into the budget this session. I know the governor's tax cut was a huge deal.
That was probably the biggest deal, the most controversy surrounding this two-year, roughly $30 billion budget. The Governor Pence, of course, pushing for a 10% personal income tax cut. He's been doing that since the campaign, made it the tentpole, really, of his gubernatorial push. Kept pushing for it as the legislature was in session, even though legislative leaders in both the House and Senate were pretty uncomfortable endorsing it, never really endorsed it at all, for that matter. But kept pushing for it right up until the end, when a compromise was announced, which is a 5% personal income tax cut over 3 years, and it doesn't begin until 2015, and then a mix of other tax cuts, including a complete elimination of the inheritance tax, continued reduction in the corporate tax rate, and a reduction in the financial institutions tax.
Andy Downs, taxes, especially cutting taxes, often a crowd pleaser, especially in traditionally conservative states like Indiana. This was a bigger fight than the governor, and then I think a lot of people expected.
Yeah, I think that's true for a couple of reasons. First of all, the folks who end up serving in the legislature quite often think longer than 4 or 8 years, even though their terms may only be 2 or 4 years. They've seen downturns in the economy before. They've seen revenue shortfalls. They've seen revenue projections come in short month after month after month. So they take, I would argue, sort of a longer-term view of things, and they don't automatically think that a tax cut, an income tax cut, is the way to run the state in a fiscally responsible manner, especially when you start with taxes that are not particularly high. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the reason that they weren't in a big hurry to endorse a 10% tax cut.
Bob Kaler.
By settling for a 5% tax cut, gosh, I'm thinking, or a 5% tax cut of the state income tax, this is down to the point where it's something like less than a dollar if you're making $900 a week. Do you feel like there's going to be, and it begins 2 years from now, is there going to be enough political advantage to make it worthwhile for legislators to have done this, or enough economic advantage?
Well, I think from a political standpoint, the moment you can say I lowered taxes is a successful moment for most political candidates, and that's really what they want to be able to say. Now, the economic benefit that comes from it, a lot of people would argue that we won't see it. We won't, you know, that dollar a week or whatever it ends up being is really not going to be enough to stimulate the economy, especially for those who are making a decent wage already. Having said that, and this is a point that the Republicans have been trying to make for, well, some time, but certainly since the passage of the budget, This is really about the tax package in total, which is, you know, from a public policy standpoint, the right thing to be thinking about. What's the mix of taxes, and does that mix of taxes result in a more or less vigorous economy? Now, this is going to take some time for us to see the effect from, I don't know that we will ever really be in a position to say, well, it was this combination of things that worked, because it is being phased in over 3 years. That's something for us to watch.
Brandon Smith, the state income tax was always kind of the headliner on this issue. In your experiences here at the State House, did it always look like it was going to be a package of tax cuts, income, inheritance, corporate tax altogether?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, the House Republican budget, when it was released, didn't include a personal income tax cut at all. The Senate was the one who instituted a roughly 3% cut, and then they ended at 5. The top legislative leaders were always very clear about this. Initially, it was not completely eliminating the inheritance tax, but getting rid of it quicker than they had already passed legislation to do so. And the corporate tax, that was something they passed in 2011. This was merely continuing what was already in the law. So it was always going to be a mix of tax cuts, so Governor Pence pushing for his 10% cut was simply never going to be a reality. The full 10% was never going to be a reality in this legislature.
And let's keep in mind there's a little bit of political spin that's already taken place here, and that's from the governor shortly after the budget was passed to say, oh, look, this package is actually better than what I had hoped for. So now he can be supportive of something that focuses more broadly on issues of taxation than just the income tax cut.
Brandon, in your interviews with the governor and staff and other legislators down there, I mean, so much money was poured, so much time from legislators and others was poured into this. So much outside money. There were commercial ad buys in the state favoring the 10% cut. Is it your sense that Pence was always going for the 10% cut, or was it? Was it going to be lower? Did he know that it was going to be lower, that it was going to be something other than that big 10% cut?
Well, he was certainly pushing hard for the 10% cut. He believed he could get it. Whether or not he honestly thought that, as it got later in the session, I will say he started to seem more open to compromise. He started mentioning things like the inheritance tax cut, wanting that to be part of the budget as well, where he had never mentioned that for all the months that he'd been talking about tax cuts. So I think as the session got closer and closer to its end, he started to realize that 10% wasn't as realistic and started to open up to more ideas, kind of soften the language a little bit. But, I mean, he told us last week after the session had ended that he pushed for that full 10% right up until the moment that they announced the final compromise on tax cuts. So he believed he could get 10%, but Brian Bosma, Luke Kenley, David Long, Tim Brown, all of the legislative leaders never really saw it that way.
Andy, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I was going to say one of the ways we know he kept pushing for it, the Senate suggested 3%, and yet the final budget had 5% in it. So that's not because the members of the House who said zero cut suddenly said, well, no, let's go higher than 3%. Somebody was putting some influence or pushing something, and that had to be coming out of the governor's office.
I want to switch here briefly to some other budget items. We saw an increase in road money given, well, not given to the state, but allocated in this budget. Brandon, it's just over $200 million for new roads projects, if I understand it right, and then another $400 million into a new trust fund, basically?
That's right. It's divided into what I like to call immediate money and long-term money. So the $215 million will be split between the state and local governments. It's a 53-47% split, with the higher percentage going to the state. And that can be used to put into roads and bridges right away, to fix the potholes that you see on roads all across the state, to really make improvements that haven't really been able to make, been able to have been made throughout the recession in a lot of places. The long-term money, that $400 million you talked about, they put into what they're calling the Major Moves 2020 Fund. This will be used for, well, they haven't said specifically which projects in the code, in the bill, they haven't laid out which projects that has to fund, but the projects that have been talked about are making, for instance, Interstate 70 and Interstate 65 six lanes wide across the entire state, finishing I-69 from Bloomington to Indianapolis, a commerce connector around Indianapolis. So it's not going to pay for all of it, and that's what everybody said when they were allocating this money. Luke Kenly was kind of the one who gave birth to this idea this year. He said, this gets us started. This starts putting money aside, really gets the process moving. You can start to bond against this money. So this is an investment in the future.
Hey, Brandon, when this has been discussed, the immediate money, the upkeep or improvements money, are you under the impression they think of that truly as maintenance money? In other words, fill the potholes, or is this really about making more substantial improvements to existing infrastructure?
I think it's probably a mix of both. I mean, there have to be improvements made. There's no doubt about it. And that was something that throughout this entire budget process, everybody talked about. They talked about driving the state and driving on these roads and just knowing that work needs to be done. So I think probably maintenance is the first priority because it can be done first and it needs to be done. But they also expected to go farther. They wanted to make a significant investment, and they felt like $215 million was a significant investment. So they'd like to see bigger projects worked on. Though, of course, the biggest projects were what the $400 million was for.
And we should note here, and Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, but of the major projects announced, nothing major up in Northeast Indiana in terms of the roads allocation.
No, when you look at Northeastern Indiana, there are groups like the Regional Chamber and others that have said for a while that Northeastern Indiana has not quite gotten its fair share, quote unquote, and they have some very specific projects that they're pushing along with other groups in this area, whether it's the Mayors and Commissioners group or others. But in terms of really big dollar things, nothing really up here. But, you know, the local groups that are pushing for infrastructure improvements aren't necessarily looking for the really big projects, but for a few significant projects that manage to get people to those major things like I-69 or the toll road.
We do need to take a quick break here. We hope you'll join the conversation. If you have a question or comment for Andy Downs or Brandon Smith, call us 800-471-9264. You can always email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. Go to our Facebook wall or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. Stay with us. Conversation continues in 2 minutes.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. This is Mrs. Jameson, the history teacher, and I just wanted to say goodbye.
On the next Fresh Air, Laura Linney talks about her starring role as a high school teacher who is battling cancer in Showtime's dark comedy, The Big C, which is now in its final season. Laura Linney on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Talk of the Nation provides you with the day's news and more, the experiences and opinions of people around the country and around the world. I'm Neil Conan. When you're looking for the latest news and how it affects you, your family, your neighbors, and your life, turn to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne, August 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum online at indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Center for Middle East Peace, presenting Faisal Istrabadi, recent Iraqi ambassador to the UN and author of Iraq's new Constitution and Bill of Rights, this Thursday, May 9th, 7 p.m., Downtown Library.
It's 1222. This is Midday Matters on WBOY at Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter. Glad to be with you and happy to be in studio with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW, and with us by phone, it's Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Gentlemen, thanks to all of you for being with us on this edition of Midday Matters. We also want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question or comment about the 2013 Indiana legislative session, call us 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. As you guys might have heard, there was a bit of education legislation introduced in the 2013 session.
Really?
And Andy, you were making a great point over the break that that's in the last several decades. It happens pretty much every year. There is some big sweeping, seemingly sweeping piece of legislation introduced in the legislature.
Yeah, it's the 40-year sprint. I can't remember who I heard call it that, but the 40-year sprint of education reform. If you think about it, each governor, and if not the governor, then certainly the legislature in the year when governors didn't have major initiatives, has proposed something: full-day kindergarten, charter schools, vouchers. You know, these are all things that formation of the education roundtable. If you keep working your way back, you can make it back to the 1970s and find some sort of significant education reform. And so the question some people are now asking is, at what point are we able to gather data and pinpoint which one of these changes has actually brought about improvement, or for that matter, decline in performance? And so from a research methodology standpoint, it's really difficult to do. But I was talking to a group of folks the other day who pointed out, well, you know, first of all, we spend a huge amount of money on education, so it should be the focus of what we're doing each legislative session, and certainly good logic there. But to another group, when I was talking with them, and I mentioned the amount of legislation, and they seemed to agree that it might be a good idea to let things settle down for a little while, and then, but it was actually a partisan group, and so they only wanted to let things settle down after they undid the things they didn't like from the other party. So I think that's part of the challenge we find ourselves in.
Well, let's get to a few specific matters here, and of course, education, part of the state budget, a 2% increase in funding this upcoming year and the year after. Brandon Smith, leaders at the State House saying that pretty much replaces the money that was taken away in the Daniels administration.
That's what Republican leaders say. Democrat leaders say that's not really the case, mm-hmm. for a couple of reasons. One, that replaces the money that was taken away in the recession, but if you hadn't taken that money away, that number would actually be much higher because of things like inflation, so that it isn't a true restoration of the cuts. The second thing they say is if you look at the school funding formula and actually break it down by school district and by school, I think Senator Tim Lannan, the Senate Minority Leader, said something like 50% of schools won't see an increase in their funding. So, yes, it is a significant step towards restoration of the cuts in some people's minds. So even Senator Luke Kenley, who chairs the Appropriations Committee, said when asked about, you know, do you need to restore that money, he said, that money's gone. It's ancient history. This is the new baseline. People need to forget about that.
And there were, well, obviously a number of other legislative items here, too, namely the voucher expansion, the expansion of the school voucher program. And Andy Downs, this, well, it continues the trend of more vouchers being offered in one of the largest voucher states in the country, one of the most expansive voucher states in the country.
Yeah, this is one of those issues that I find intriguing, because if you look at poll results from the Bowen Center, and I believe this is 2 years in a row they've asked this question, do you favor an expansion of vouchers? And as I recall, the numbers are that in general, folks do not. It's not some astronomically large percentage that are opposed to or who are opposed to it, but in general, not in favor of it. Yet it's something that passed and and some would argue passed pretty easily. And that might be because of the supermajority held by Republicans in both chambers and a very sympathetic governor. But in the end, legislators were able to do this and fairly easily, which makes me wonder if two things. First, the Bowen Center poll is done based on all folks in the state, not just registered voters and likely voters. So I wonder if likely voters have a difference of opinion than Hoosiers in general. And then secondarily, are there simply that many districts where this makes sense? And so you find people clustered in parts of the state where the issue matters the most to them. And unfortunately, we don't have enough data to really get at that.
And so, I would argue though that the passage wasn't quite that easy. It certainly was in the House, and that was always going to be in the House. But the Senate only passed it by a very small margin. I think it was 27-23, which for the Senate is a pretty small margin. And the Senate, and you have to remember too that it was a significantly scaled down version of voucher expansion. The voucher expansion that the governor and the House proposed eliminated the public school attendance requirements, that in order to get a voucher, you no longer have to attend public school at any grade. The Senate, and particularly Lou Kenley, were very uncomfortable with the funding implications of that, particularly because no one could give them a good answer as to how much it costs, which goes back to Andy's point that he made about the difficulty of trying to study this issue when you keep pushing forward without taking time to really consider what it's done. And that's a point that Lou Kenley would bring up, is that we don't really know if this is working or not. So in combination with the voucher expansion, which as it passed, ultimately passed, maintains a public school attendance requirement for kindergarten, it's also going to study the school choice, the voucher program, to see what help it's actually bringing to the state.
We're talking today with Brandon Smith, IPBS State House reporter, and Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics about the 2013 Indiana legislative session. If you have a question or comment, we'd love for you to join the conversation today at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. Bob Kaler.
Brandon, what was your read on exactly what legislators objected to about Common Core that made this such an eruption of controversy when it hadn't been for a couple of years before this?
This one is a tricky issue because it really doesn't follow partisan lines per se. It was largely Republicans, very, very, very conservative Republicans fighting against other Republicans for the most part and some Democrats. The primary objection, well, I'd say there's two primary objections, and they may be the same thing ultimately in just calling it different things. One of them is that there were complaints primarily driven by parents who felt like the Common Core standards aren't good enough, that particularly in math, it actually takes us backwards in terms of the strength of educational standards. The other problem, and it's a much more political problem, was the perception that this Common Core thing is being driven by the federal government and by President Obama and Arne Duncan, his Secretary of Education. That couldn't be further from the truth. While the President and Arne Duncan are big fans of Common Core and have begun to tie the No Child Left Behind Act with Common Core a little bit, and particularly the flexibility waivers therein, it wasn't a federal government initiative. This was developed on a kind of national basis, but it wasn't the federal government. So when you had someone like House Education Chair Bob Boehning, who is as Republican as there is, having to defend Common Core against charges that it's socialism, you've got to wonder how far to the right its critics are.
Looks like we have a caller on the line here. We are talking with Andy Downs and with Brandon Smith about the 2013 legislative session. If you have a question or comment, call us 800-471-9264. Post on our Facebook wall, send us a tweet or email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. Let's open the phones before we have to go to a break here and see if we can get Glenn on the line. Glenn, welcome to Midday Matters. Please be brief. We only have a few minutes here.
Okay. I'm from the state of Tennessee, and we have these same kind of issues and the passage of this school vouchers. And I've noticed that it came into existence under George Bush with the No Child Left Behind, and I think it's a cover-up for really resegregating school systems, privatizing schools. It's appalling to me that it's moving up into Indiana as well. The things that we achieved and accomplished in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are being overturned, and children are being left behind.
That's
my comment.
Glenn, we appreciate your call here. And Andy, let's start with you. Certainly, voucher programs, the so-called privatization of schools has been a Republican talking point, a Republican goal in many states for a long time now.
It has been. And the idea is that competition will make things better. And in many instances, competition does make things better. But the problem is, how do you inject that competition without doing damage? And so, for example, if when a student leaves a public school and heads off taking a voucher with him or her to go elsewhere, the amount of money that goes with that student is the per capita funding. But that doesn't change what has to happen in the classroom where that child used to be. So instead of 26 students, there are now 25. Or instead of 25, there are 24. And so the cost issues don't really balance out all that well. And once again, this is one of those areas where we have a fabulous opportunity to collect data along the way so that in 1 year or 5 years or 6 years, we can actually say, here's what we think the effect of these changes has been. But we have to be very cautious and methodical and begin collecting that data now so that we have it longitudinally.
And Brandon Smith, it seems that Glenn mentioned his concern that privatization, that voucher programs are a resegregation of schools. It doesn't seem like necessarily a racial matter so much as an economics matter for the folks arguing in favor of this.
No, that's precisely correct. And the argument against vouchers is and specifically Indiana's voucher system, where it gives about $4,500, it will end up giving about after this expansion bill passed, I think about $4,800 in the amount of the voucher. The argument being, well, that's nice, but that's not going to pay for all of private education. So really the only people who can take advantage of this are the upper end of the middle, or the people who are eligible in terms of income level. So it's not really going to help the poorest of the poor, which is what they say vouchers should do. It's really going to help those people who only needed that little tiny boost to get their kids to private school.
Andy Downs, last word before we go to break.
And actually, Brandon can comment on this, but when you look at the rallies that took place at the State House over the last couple of years, it was not just a group of affluent white folks who were showing up to those rallies. They were actually pretty diverse. We can argue about how engineered those events were, but it was not necessarily something that would make people automatically say, by looking at it, this is just about segregation, even though that may end up being something that happens because of it.
We do need to take a quick break here. Glenn, thank you very much for your call. We hope more folks join the conversation this hour. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. Stay with us, back in 4 minutes.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. This is Mrs. Jameson, the history teacher, and I just wanted to say goodbye.
On the next Fresh Air, Laura Linney talks about her starring role as a high school teacher who is battling cancer in Showtime's dark comedy, The Big C, which is now in its final season. Laura Linney on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Delia with WBOI News. Indiana hospitals that treat high numbers of poor and uninsured residents are waiting to see what impact the federal health care overhaul has on them. The law will give more people access to insurance when it takes effect January 1st, but hospitals say uncertainty over whether Indiana will expand Medicaid services makes it hard to know what to expect. Hospital officials say some of the law's changes could boost their incomes, but note that safety net hospitals also will bear the brunt of $30 billion in cuts over the next decade. CEO Eric Looper of St. Joseph Hospital in Fort Wayne tells the Journal-Gazette that trying to figure out the law's impact on the bottom line is, quote, a moving target. Election officials plan to thoroughly review and clean up Indiana's voter rolls on a statewide basis for the first time in 7 years. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on what voters can expect in the coming months.
Legislation passed during the 2013 session requires a statewide mailing to verify and update voter registration information every 2 years and puts money behind the effort. Secretary of State Connie Lawson says voters will receive postcards in the mail with their registration info. They mail the cards back with any changes listed. And Lawson says the mailing will also remove voters from the rolls.
If that postcard comes back non-deliverable, then that starts the process where a voter is marked inactive. Then a second mail piece goes out, and if that's still non-deliverable, then the voter is removed from the poll list.
Fort Wayne Democrat Phil Giaquinta, who serves on the House Elections Committee, says cleaning up the voter rolls is important, but the state should also be doing more to limit things like the constant changing of precinct locations.
Local governments have been pressed pressure to save money. Then on the other hand, it can lead to more difficulty for the average voter to know where to go to vote.
Giaquinta says Indiana needs to spend more on encouraging people to vote. Lawson says her office works on voter outreach, but that candidates and ballot issues are often the biggest factors in voter turnout. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And some writers say Amtrak's passenger service between Chicago and Indianapolis would be more popular if there were more frequent options for catching a train. Federal funding cuts are prompting Amtrak's plans to end in October the 4-day-a-week Hoosier State route, with stops in Crawfordsville, Lafayette, and Dyer. Amtrak's 3-day-a-week Cardinal line running from Chicago through Indianapolis to the East Coast will continue. State officials are studying the estimated $4 million to $5 million a year it might cost to continue the service. Taking a quick look at the WBOY weather forecast, a 20% chance of some showers after 1 p.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 70. This evening, mostly cloudy with a low around 52. And tomorrow, Tuesday, it looks like we may see some scattered showers with a possible thunderstorm in the afternoon. Mostly cloudy throughout the day with a high near 73, dropping down to 51 Tuesday night. You're listening to 89.1 FM, WBOY Fort Wayne. And now back to Midday Matters.
Twenty minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, and it's Midday Matters on WBOY Fort Wayne. Talking on this program about the 2013 legislative session in Indiana that just wrapped up at the end of last month. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment for our panel today, call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We were talking in the last segment about the multitude, as there always is, of education legislation that came through this session. And Brandon Smith, we can't leave the education topic without talking about the armed personnel bill. Obviously, the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, on a lot of people's minds as this 2013 session started. Can you tell us a little bit about just how that bill evolved?
Sure. It started out and actually finished this way. It's about what they call school resource officers, who are trained law enforcement. They're police officers with extra training to work in the school environment. They're more than just cops in schools. They're meant to be counselors, help with, interact with kids, all sorts of things. In the House Education Committee, when the bill came over from the Senate about two-thirds of the way into the session, a little bit of language got put into it that said, that completely changed the bill and said every public school in Indiana has to have at least one, has to have unarmed personnel on school grounds at all times. And because obviously the schools can't expect to be can't be expected to hire police officers. This armed personnel could be a teacher or a principal, and that really, well, that gripped the State House for about a week and a half before it was completely purged from the bill entirely, after drawing an incredible amount of controversy. And the problem there seemed to be two things. One, nobody liked the mandate part of it. Nobody thought that you should have to, you know, that these schools should be required to put a gun in the school. And the other part of it was arming teachers and principals with a seemingly minimal amount of training.
Andy Downs, I want to put this to you because this idea of armed personnel in schools comes it came almost parallel with the National Rifle Association's proposal that the very same thing happened nationwide in public schools. Are you surprised that this bill failed, or that this provision in the bill failed?
I'm actually not, although I think it's a good example of how the state legislature from time to time can get a little paternalistic and think that they know what is really best for constituents within a particular area. And we see this on a regular basis. It's a tension that's existed in Indiana for almost a couple hundred years now, I should say, or just short of 200 years. So it's not surprising. And I don't think that, some people may say, well, it was the NRA pushing the issue. No, I think this was a fairly obvious solution that was going to be suggested in a whole lot of states.
Well, and Brandon Smith, I mean, this did appear to come up somewhat independently of the NRA's proposal, but as parallel as they seem to run in the first part of this year, it didn't necessarily seem like a coincidence either.
No, and the NRA's name did come up when the author of the provision, Seymour Representative Jim Lucas, who was a freshman representative this year, which is important to note, I think, when he was asked what kind of training would have to be provided to these teachers or principals in order to arm them and put them in a school, he declined to name specifics, but he did mention that the NRA was more than happy to provide that training. So the NRA's name did come up, and I don't think it's a coincidence, obviously, but this was a fairly independent, like Andy said, a fairly independent effort by this seemingly one representative that somehow got support in the House Education Committee.
Yeah, and let's face it, from the NRA's perspective, once they hear about legislation like this, well, why wouldn't they want to contact the
Precisely.
Person who's sponsoring it and say, oh, we'll provide the education, we'll play a good role for you.
Do you guys expect this particular provision to come up again in 2014? Andy, let's start with you.
No.
Yeah, I'm with Brandon. I don't think so. I think this was sort of a spur of the moment sort of thing, and obviously legislators realize that local districts should be able to make this decision for themselves, and probably will be able to. And I'm not so sure the state wants to put the amount of money that it would take behind such a program out there for everyone to use.
That's a part of this, and I wouldn't rule out a bill being authored, but I don't see if that bill does get authored, it won't go anywhere.
We're going to take a break in just a moment before we get into the last 15 minutes or so of the program here. But Brandon, correct me if I'm wrong. This was a mandate for schools to have these officers, but state law already allows schools to put those types of folks into their facilities already.
Absolutely. If you're a teacher with a license to carry a firearm and you get permission from your school and your school district, you can carry a gun in the school building. That is currently law. This would simply have been a mandate for every school to have one.
We're going to wrap up our conversation coming up in just a few minutes on the 2013 legislative session. We hope to hear from you this hour. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. This is Mrs. Jameson, the history teacher, and I just wanted to say goodbye.
On the next Fresh Air, Laura Linney talks about her starring role as a high school teacher who is battling cancer in Showtime's dark comedy, The Big C, which is now in its final season. Laura Linney on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
My mother's always yelling at me. How are you supposed to find a man?
Amanda is gay. 16 years ago on NPR, she talked about coming out. Now Amanda and her mother are part of our new series, Teenage Diaries Revisited.
I brag about you to my friends. And I say, she's gay, you know. That's fine.
That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News. This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
In medical circles, it's called the conversation, when doctors sit down with patients or family members to tell them there's no longer any realistic hope. And when doctors are less than forthcoming out of sensitivity or haste, difficult decisions become all the more complex. I'm Neil Conan, Doctors, Decisions, and How We Die. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Just 12 minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, it's Midday Matters on WBOY Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler, and with us in studio as well, Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW, and with us by phone from his vacation, no less, just recovering from these things, it's Brandon Smith, our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We hope you'll join the conversation today at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet at Midday Matters. One of course, the major issues that we didn't quite get resolved in this session was implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And Brandon Smith, I hope you'll fill us in just a little bit here on where we stand now with implementation of the act here in Indiana. It seems like so far it's been a story of, kind of stalling out in terms of our momentum.
And that hasn't changed. The situation is this. Governor Pence, supported by Republicans in the legislature, are trying to negotiate with the federal government for the state to expand health care through something like the Healthy Indiana Plan. It can't be exactly the Healthy Indiana Plan because that doesn't it wouldn't work, logistically speaking. It doesn't have all the requirements you need to expand health care. But they want to do something fairly close to it. So far, the federal government really hasn't supported that idea, but we're taking a wait-and-see approach. The problem that Democrats had with this session and with that plan as a whole is there doesn't seem to be a plan B. What happens if the federal government comes back and says no to the Healthy Indiana Plan entirely? We haven't really gotten a good answer either from Republican legislators or the governor as to what the next step is at that point.
Bob Kaler.
Well, I guess I've been assuming that what happens is we default to not expanding Medicare, sort of the way that we defaulted to having the feds run an exchange when it comes time to purchase, because we didn't develop our own program for a health insurance exchange.
Well, certainly we won't expand Medicaid. That's not a question. The problem is that the federal government can come back and say two things, actually. Well, they can say more than two things, but if they can say no to expansion through something like the Healthy Indiana Plan, they can also say no to the Healthy Indiana Plan entirely, which would mean the Healthy Indiana Plan will no longer be in effect in the state at all, which would leave a huge segment of the population.
So we would step backwards. Okay.
Yeah. We only have about 10 minutes left in the program here. Let's go to the phones here and see if we can get Daniel on the line. Daniel, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters. Well, Daniel, are you with us?
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I am unaware of the first half of the program. Maybe you touched on this, but as far as I remember, we get 100% of our electricity from coal generation, and as far as renewable energy, have there been any parts of the last legislative session that addressed moving toward a renewable future, or just am not aware of what's gone on in that topic this last session?
Bob Kaler.
Well, I'm not sure what was done in the General Assembly. I'll let Brandon touch on that, but I know that Indiana and Michigan has nuclear in its in its portfolio. It's got hydroelectric in its portfolio of energy. It has a significant share of it comes from wind power now, probably in the high single-digit percentage of its power comes from wind power. And wind power is across the state is around 2.5% or 3% of the energy comes from that. So, so renewable sources are not being ignored.
And Brandon Smith, in terms of the 2013 session anyway, energy was not terribly high on the list.
No, because they're leaving that one to the governor. Governor Pence has said since he took office that he will be developing a new energy plan for the state. And that wasn't something that was going to happen in the 2 months or 3 months since he took office. That is more of a long-term thing. He has split out a new Office of Energy Development, which was something technically done by legislation. But his administration will be developing a new energy plan over the coming months and possibly even years, though I would think it's more months. And I think renewable sources like wind, nuclear, all of these things will be on the table. What will be in the final results remains to be seen, but they will be part of the discussion, no doubt about it.
And the sources actually for this are kind of interesting because you look at places that went to fracking very quickly and thought they would take advantage of that. Then suddenly certain prices went down while some others went up and things didn't seem as financially viable as they did, you know, even months earlier. Coal gasification plants, maybe not the savior that some people were thinking they would be. This is not something that's really all that static. We think that, you know, fossil fuel-based energy sources have been doing it for us for decades, so we can develop a policy that will take us four decades. I'm not so sure that it's really that static any longer. I think that it will be a more diversified and certainly much more, I'll say volatile, that might not be the right term to use here, much more volatile
fluid
arrangement.
Fluid doesn't work either.
Much more volatile arrangement than it used to be.
Daniel, we appreciate the call. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. We have about 6 minutes left in the program here. I do want to get back briefly to the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid. Brandon, is it just the fact that we're basically waiting on the governor to act or for the governor and the federal government to come to an accord, or does the legislature still have business to attend to before January 1st, 2014?
No, they've left it entirely to the governor, which was widely criticized, certainly by Democrats. And there were a few Republicans who weren't particularly thrilled with that course of action either, that they feel like the legislature should be able to weigh in some measure. But essentially the only way that the Republican leadership decided to weigh in was just give power to the governor to negotiate for expansion through something like the Healthy Indiana Plan.
It will be interesting to see that as other states become more concrete in their plans, will that maybe start to limit the number of options available to Indiana or sort of force us in a direction that in some respects maybe we won't want to go, but it seems to be the option that's left available to us.
And what we would hear from Democrats, particularly towards the end of session, was it's going to come October when other states that have decided to expand health care under Medicaid, when all these people in every surrounding state, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Illinois, will begin to receive health care coverage, and Hoosiers, whose federal tax dollars are going to pay for the health care of people in all of our surrounding states, will be left out in the cold, most likely. So if that happens, it could force action because there will be a significant segment of the population not particularly happy with the governor or Republican leaders.
Well, we'll certainly have to revisit the issue coming up in future programs here. But we did want to take a few minutes at the end of this show to remember a former governor who passed away this weekend at the age of 95, Otis Doc Bowen. And Andy, a big smile on your face as we mentioned that name. For folks who may not have been old enough to remember his time in office, remember him. Tell us a little bit about the legacy of Governor Bowen.
There are several things to remember and remember fondly about Governor Bowen. Some people would say some of these we shouldn't be remembering so fondly, but one of them that we should is that he was part of an era where folks really were sort of gentlemanly, to use a term that doesn't get heard that often any longer. He was somebody who believed you treated people with respect and sort of used those good good values that we're all brought up thinking are right. You're polite to people and they'll be polite to you. You try to address problems that the community is facing and set aside partisan ideals. In fact, he came from a divided household himself, one parent a D, one parent an R, and somehow managed to survive in the world. He was a county coroner, but he also served in the General Assembly, managed to serve in leadership in the General Assembly, and at one point did seek the governor's office, was held at bay by Governor Whitcomb, but did become the governor and was the first in the modern era to get to serve two consecutive terms. That's something that we take for granted these days, but you know, back in the 1970s was not the case. And in his two terms, one of the most significant things he did, a lot of people would argue, is actually tax restructuring. And that tax restructuring not only raised the sales tax, and that might be the part people don't like, but it capped property taxes, which I think people will like, and also introduced the option of local income taxes for people in counties and cities. And so really began to diversify streams of revenue for local governments in ways that we still see used today. And certainly the way that was done did affect us for a generation. We're seeing some shift in that now, but obviously significant. And I think when we're talking about this 40 years from now, we will refer to that as perhaps one of the most important things. And then, of course, the fact that the man served at the federal level as the Secretary of Health and Human Services is certainly worth mentioning.
Well, let's mention it for a few moments more. I mean, and another Indiana boy made good, served under President Reagan at Health and Human Services.
Yeah, and he was there at a time when the AIDS crisis was really starting to come into coming to the attention of a lot of folks. He was there helping with educational programs, awareness programs. I'm not sure that it's true, but I read somewhere recently that he's the person who said when you have sex with somebody, it's not with just that one person, but with the people they've had sex with as well. And so, you know, that sort of awareness and destigmatizing the disease in ways that I think are quite beneficial are things that he can be proud of. He did once say about HHS was that it's a job with an awful lot of responsibility and almost no authority to do anything.
A frustrating position to be in for a former governor.
Quite.
Simply put. Well, we've reached the end of this program, unfortunately. I know a lot of folks wanted to get in on a few issues, but we did want to get that remembrance in before we said so long today. Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW, thank you very much for being with us for this edition of our program.
Thanks for having me.
And Brandon Smith, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter, thank you so much for taking time to be with us as well.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
You can hear Brandon's reporting most days right here on WBOI. I'm Sean Beter for Bob Kaler. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 FM HD Channel 1 and online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock. Fresh Air with your local host, Katie Anderson, is coming up next. Stay with us. It's WBOI.